with her and some of her friends, lovely, lovely ladies, all tanned, tanned and rich. Everything was nice and friendly, and phone numbers were exchanged, and we had an enjoyable evening that went on into the night, and I got real friendly with Mr. Dole's pretty daughter, and I'm sure we drank lots of pineapple juice. This was before security. We were let loose on the world on our own then, so all sorts of shit happened. We're here and doling it out at the mansion. And in the morning, Mr. Dole comes in, and there's this sort of embarrassed, "Oh, Daddy?" He sees this bacchanal scene in his lounge with Keith Richards and me, and his daughter says, "Let me introduce you to my new friends." Keith's just out the door like a shadow, but Mr. Dole, instead of calling the dogs and saying, "Eat these people," says, "Very happy to meet you." Daddy is actually gracious. This is uncomfortable as hell because I'm screwing the pineapple princess. Mr. Dole gives me his card, saying, "Well, obviously you're my daughter's friends. If there's ever anything I can do for you if you're passing through Hawaii, give me a call. Here's my private number. Go straight through." So I take Mr. Dole's card, put it in my wallet, and don't think any more about it. Now, on the verge of many years of hard labor in the Texas sun, I have my one phone call, and I don't have any numbers to contact anybody. Nobody from the Stones party knows where the hell we are. Then I find Mr. Dole's card in my wallet, the only card I have and the only number I have. So I call this number, and I amazingly get through to Mr. Dole. And I say, "Mr. Dole, do you remember that scantily clad guy and that half-dead-looking Englishman who were in your living room the other day? Well, this is half of them." "Oh, hello, Bobby. How are you?" I say, "We've had a little problem here. They found this and that and syringes, and we don't know what to do." And he says, "Where are you? What happened exactly? What flight were you on?" And I tell him, and he says, "Well, I'll see what I can do." And he hangs up. Now, I don't know what's happening to Keith, but I'm scared to death. I thought we were really going to Leavenworth. I was just waiting for the guys to come with the chains and take us away. So I'm sitting back there, partitioned off by this mirror glass from these clowns that have booked us, and all of a sudden, the phone rings at this guy's desk, the one who's been talking all this shit at us, and you can tell just by the change in his posture that something has got him going. He looks back at me, looks back at the phone, hangs the phone up, and he just kind of shakes his head very slowly and tears up the charge sheet. They give the shit back, put us on the plane, and say, "Don't ever do this again." And we fly happily off into the sunset. But it doesn't finish there. We get on the plane, and I'm going, "Fuck, man. Better make some phone calls to get some shit for Frisco when we get there. Know anybody in Frisco? Who do we call?" Now, for some reason, I pull out my wallet. I immediately feel these two unfamiliar bumps under its skin. Unmistakable. In there are two 00 caps full of smack, which is a damn good whack of pure heroin. The caps came from the chicks in Adelaide, our Sheilas. Customs had been through me like a dose of salts. They'd search me, they'd been up my arse. If I'd been busted, I would never have got back in the country again. How did they miss him? You find that a lot with customs people. If you think you're clean, you are. And I was totally convinced I had cleaned out my shit. So I immediately went to the bathroom, and suddenly, everything went rosy. We'll share one cap now. Snort it because we don't have any needles. That will keep us going, and then we can make phone calls when we get there. Another close shave. The dog that didn't bark in the night. Bobby and I seemed to be lucky in combination, especially at airports in those years. Once, going through security in New York, Bob was taking care of the baggage. One bag of mine had to go in the hold. It couldn't go through checks. It had a shooter, my .38 special, in it, with 500 rounds of ammunition. I used to carry a lot of heat. None of my guns were legal. I'm not allowed to own firearms. I'm a convicted felon. In the hold, it would have been cool as part of the general baggage. And Bobby got it fucking wrong. And I saw the bag with the shooter in it going through the X-ray. Fuck! No! I yelled out, Bob! And everybody that's looking at the machinery turned round and looked at me and took their eyes off the screen. They didn't see it go through. I went straight back to Jamaica, where I left Anita and the children. We stayed in Mame Bay that spring of 1973. It was already getting a little rough in some ways. Anita was beginning to act in unpredictable ways. She began to suffer from paranoia. During my absence on tour, began to collect a lot of people who took her hospitality for granted. A bad combination. Even when I was there, we had a pretty rowdy house. Without realizing it, we were shocking the neighborhood. White man with a big house, and everybody knew that Rastas were around there every night, recording, playing music. The neighbors wouldn't have minded over the weekend or something, but not on a Monday or a Tuesday. We were starting to do it every damn night. And also, the pong coming out of that house. These guys were burning weed by the pound in the chalice. The smoke would go for a mile. It didn't suit the neighbors. I learned later that Anita had also sorely pissed a few people off. She had been warned a few times, and she'd been excessively rude to the constabulary or anyone who complained. They were calling her Rude Girl. They called her, more comically, Mussolini, because she spoke Italian. Anita can be rough. I was married to her without being married to her, and she was in trouble. I left for England, and the cops hit the house at night, almost before I'd landed in London. Many cops in plain clothes. There were shots. One of them apparently fired by an Officer Brown when Anita threw a pound of weed past him into the garden. They took Anita, after a lot of struggling, to jail in St. Anne's and left the kids. Marlon was barely 4 and Angela was 1 year old. And Marlon, at least, watched this. Scary shit. Me, I'm in London finding out what's happened. My immediate reaction was to take the first flight back to Jamaica, but I was persuaded that it was better to put the pressure on from London. If I'd gone there, they'd have probably popped me too. The brothers and sisters had taken the kids and whisked them up the steer town before the authorities had thought, what are we going to do about these two children? And they lived up there while Anita was in jail, and the Rastas took perfect care of them. And that was very important to me. It was a huge relief to know they were safe and protected, safer than if they'd been whipped off to a foster home. Angie and Marlon up there with their playmates, who still remember them, who are now great big guys. Then I could concentrate on springing Anita. There are myths and rumors about Anita in jail, mostly originated by Spanish Tony and his tabloid ghostwriter in Tony's book about me, and copied faithfully by other book writers, that Anita was raped in jail, that I had to pay a very large sum of money to spring her, that it was all a conspiracy by the white nabobs of Jamaica, and so on. But none of this happened. The cells in the St. Anne slammer weren't nice. There was nothing to sleep on. Anita was barely allowed to wash, and it was crawling with cockroaches, none of which did much to calm the bouts of paranoia and hallucination that she suffered then. And they mocked her. Rude girl, rude girl. But she wasn't raped, and I didn't have to pay a bribe. The bust was simply punishment for ignoring their warnings. All this was explained to the lawyer, Hugh Hart, who came to Springer. He discovered that the police were relieved to be rid of her. They didn't know what to do with her. They hadn't yet charged her with any offense. Hart got her out by promising to get her off the island. So she was driven home to collect the children, and then to a plane for London. Anita was not making a lot of the right moves at the right time. At the same time, Anita's Anita. You don't take her on for nothing. I still loved her, and she was the mother of my kids. I don't let go. I have to be kicked out. But Anita and I were starting to be no good together. My Jamaican roots, by contrast with Anita's expulsion, would only get deeper, even though I wasn't able to get back there for a few years. Before Anita's bust, I'd already realized I needed a little more protection, that we were getting exposed on the beach at Mame Bay. I already loved Jamaica enough to look for a really nice house there. I didn't want any more renter houses, so we went touring with our landlord at the time, Ernie Smart, who showed me Tommy Steele's house tucked away up in the hills above Ocho Rios. Its name was Point of View, and I still own it to this day. This house had a perfect location, sitting on a small cliff looking out over the bay in fairly dense hillside woodland. Its location had been picked with the greatest care by an Italian prisoner of war called Andrea Mafassante, who had been shipped out to Jamaica with a bunch of other Italian POWs. Mafassante was an architect, and while he was a prisoner, he was also looking around for perfect spots to build houses. And he either got them made or he sold his drawings, because many houses there are attributed to him. He was there for 2 or 3 years, studying wind and weather, which is why the house is slightly L-shaped. During the day, you get the breeze off the sea from the front, where you're overlooking the harbor. At 6 o'clock in the evening, the breeze changes and comes down from the mountain. He had it shaped so the cool breeze comes down past the kitchen from the land. A brilliant piece of architecture. I got it for 80 grand. The house was kind of dark with air conditioning machines, which I tore out immediately. Because of Mafasati's design, the house is naturally ventilated. We just put some more fans in, and it's always worked that way since then. I bought it and left it on the vine. It was a very busy period, and also I was on the dope. We toured Europe in September and October 1973, after the release of Goat's Head Soup. The lineup now included, almost permanently until 1977, Billy Preston playing keyboards, usually organ. He'd already had a meteoric career, playing with Little Richard and with the Beatles almost as a fifth member of the band, and writing and churning out his own number one hits. He was from California, born in Houston, a soul and gospel musician who ended up playing with almost everybody who was good. We now toured with two trumpets, two saxophones, and two keyboards, Billy's organ alongside Nicky Hopkins' piano, as sidemen. Billy produced a different sound for us. If you listen to the records with Billy Preston, like Melody, he fit perfectly. But all the way through a show with Billy, it was like playing with somebody who was going to put his own stamp on everything. He was used to being a star in his own right. There was one time in Glasgow, when he was playing so loud, he was drowning out the rest of the band. I took him backstage and showed him the blade. "You know what this is, Bill?" "Dear William, if you don't turn that fucking thing down right now, you're going to feel it. It's not Billy Preston and the Rolling Stones. You are the keyboard player with the Rolling Stones." But most of the time, I never had a problem with it. Certainly, Charlie quite enjoyed the jazz influence, and we did a lot of good stuff together. Billy died of complications brought about by various kinds of overindulgence in 2006. And there was no reason for him to have gone that way. He could have gone up and up. He had all the talent in the world. I think he'd been in the game too long. He started very young, and he was gay at a time when nobody could be openly gay, which added difficulties to his life. Billy could be, most of the time, a bundle of fun, but sometimes he would get on the rag. I had to stop him beating up his boyfriend in an elevator once. "Billy, hold it right there or I'll tear your wig off." He had this ludicrous afro wig. Meanwhile, he looked perfectly good with the Billy Eckstein look underneath. I was taking a pee with Bobby Keys in Innsbruck just after a show. And Bobby usually has a joke or two at these moments, but he's very quiet. And he goes, "I got bad news. GP's dead." It was like a kick to the solar plexus. I looked at him. "Graham? Dead? I thought he was straight. I thought he was on the ups." "Story later," says Bobby. "All I've heard is that he's dead." Oh, my man. You never know quite how it's going to affect you. It never hits you at once. Another goodbye to another good friend. We heard later that Graham was clean when he went overboard. He took a normal size dose. Oh, just one. Cold turkey had already wiped out his body's resilience against it, and boom. There's that fatal mistake with junkies. When you've cleaned up, the body's just been through that shock. They think, I'll just use one little hit. But they give themselves the same shot that they were taking the week before, to which they built up a tolerance and amazing proportions, which is why the come down is so heavy. And the body just says, well, fuck it, I give up. If you're going to do things like that, you should try and remember the amount you took the first time you ever took it. Start again. A third less. A pinch. In order to deal with Graham's death, I said, I can't stay in Innsbruck tonight. I'm going to rent a car and we're going to Munich and we're going on an impossible task. We're going to look for one woman. Because I knew about her, I'd seen her once or twice, and she fascinated me. I know this is pointless, but we're going into Munich to look for her. Let's go tonight. Let's just forget about it and go do something else. I hate all that crying shit and moping. There's nothing you can do about it. The fucker's dead. And all you do is get mad at him for dying. So you take your mind off it. I'm going to look for one of the most beautiful women in the world. I'll never find her, but that's what we'll go for. A focus, a target. And Bobby and I rented a BMW, this was 1 a.m, and took off. The target was Uschi Obermeier. If there was one thing that could soothe my soul, it was her. She was beautiful. She was quite famous in Germany as a model who had graduated into an icon of the student protest movement that was traumatizing relations between the generations in Germany and threatening to tear the country apart. She was the poster girl of the left. Her picture was everywhere, and she was a mad rock and roll fan, which is how she'd found her way to Mick at first and how I'd met her, very briefly, once. Mick had invited her to come to Stuttgart, and she was looking for him in the hotel. She ran into me instead, and I took her to Mick's door. But I'd seen her picture on posters and in magazines, and it was something about her that got to me. Uschi's boyfriend, a guy called Rainer Langens, had been one of the founders of Commune One, a public living designed to wage war against the nuclear family in the authoritarian state. She'd been co-opted into Commune One when she took up with Rainer, but Uschi's other title, of which she was proud, was the Bavarian Barbarian. She had never taken the ideology seriously, openly drinking banned Pepsi Cola and smoking menthol cigarettes and upsetting other commune dictates. She was photographed naked by Stern magazine rolling joints. She was certainly wholehearted in her desire to outrage the German bourgeoisie. But when a commune world hardened up into two camps, terror groups like Bader-Meinhof on one hand and the Greens on the other, Uschi retired from the fray, at least retired from Rainer, and went back to Munich. Her road is littered with guys who tried to tame her. They tried to tame something that's untamable. She's the best bad girl I know. Anyway, that night we checked into the Bayer-Scherhof, where everybody's got a Rembrandt over his bed. A real one. Bob said, right, what are we going to do now, Keith? I said, Bob, now we're going down to Schwabing and hit the strip, the club circuit. Let's do what Graham would have done if we'd croaked. I said, we've got to look for Uschi Obermeyer in this city. I've got to have a target. No particular reason. It was the only thing I knew in Munich to aim at. I didn't even know if she was in town. So we buffed ourselves up a bit and started to hit the clubs. And things were rocking. But it wasn't what we were looking for. And by about the fifth or sixth club, there's some damn good records being played. So I went up and talked to the DJ who I happened to know, George the Greek. And on top of that, he happened to know the Obermeyer. But even if I find her, what am I going to do? I'm in no condition to put the make on her. There's not much time anyway. So, okay. Well, we've actually found someone who knows her. This is already a miracle. But I'm lost for a plan. George says, I know her address. But she's with her old man. I said, George, let's go round there. And we parked opposite the flat and I said, George, will you go up and say that KR is looking for her? I was determined to make the full circle with GP dying. And George goes up, knocks on a door, and out she struts, just to the window, and goes, who are you? Why? I don't know why. A friend of mine's just died, and I'm pretty fucked up. I just want to say hello. You were the target and we found you. We'll leave it at that. Then she came down and gave me a kiss and went back upstairs. But hey, we actually pulled it off. Mission accomplished. The second time I tried to get in touch with Uschi, I got Freddie Sessler to track her down on the phone. He called her agency, and the agent said, I'm not allowed to give those numbers out. And there's Freddie greasing the line, and Freddie could grease like nobody. Freddie was versed in many languages. Uschi and I didn't speak each other's language. When I got a number and she answered, she said, hi, Mick. I said, no, it's Keith. She was living in Hamburg at the time, and I sent a car round to drive her to Rotterdam. She basically had to do a runner from her old man. They had a fight. She got in the car and came to Rotterdam. She ripped my earring out that night in the bed. We were in this Japanese-style hotel in Rotterdam. Next morning, I realize my ear is stuck with my own blood to the pillow, as a result of which I have a permanent malformation of the right earlobe. With Uschi Obermeyer, especially at that time, it was lust, pure and simple. And then she grew on me and entered my heart. We draw pictures or use sign language. But even if we couldn't talk to each other, I'd found a friend. As simple as that, really. And I loved her dearly. We dabbled around off and on with each other in the 70s. And then she took off with her new love. Boyfriend Dieter Buckhorn to Afghanistan, and she slipped from my mind and my heart. And then I heard that she died of a miscarriage somewhere in Turkey, which was almost true, but it turned out she was smarter than that. I found out the real story many years later on a beach in Mexico on the most important day of my life. This was a terrible period for casualties. Towards the end of that summer, Gus, my granddad, died. Michael Cooper, my deep mate, committed suicide, fragile psyche. I'd always seen it as a potential. All the good ones die on you. And where does that leave me? The only answer is to make new friends. But then some of the live ones dropped off the active list. We wore out Jimmy Miller, who slowly succumbed to the dope and ended up carving swastikas into the mixing board while he worked on his swan song album for us, Goat's Head Soup. Andy Johns lasted until late 1973. We were cutting It's Only Rock and Roll in Munich when he got fired for the same reason. Hitting the hard stuff too hard. He survived and worked ever after. And then my buddy, Bobby Keys. I couldn't save him from his own rock and roll shipwreck around that same time. Bobby went down in a tub of Dom Perignon. Bobby Keys, so the story goes, is the only man who knows how many bottles of it takes to fill a bath, because that's what he was floating in. This was just before the second-to-last gig on the 73 European tour in Belgium. No sign of Bobby at the band assembly that day, and finally, I was asked if I knew where my buddy was. There had been no reply from his hotel room. So I went to his room and said, "Bob, we gotta go. We gotta go right now. He's got a cigar, bathtub full of champagne, and this French chick in with him." And he said, "Fuck off." So be it. Great image and everything like that, but you might regret it, Bob. The accountant informed Bobby afterwards that he had earned no money at all on the tour as a result of that bathtub. In fact, he owed, and it took me 10 goddamn years or more to get him back in the band, because Mick was implacable, and rightly so. And Mick can be merciless in that way. I couldn't answer for Bobby. All I could do was help him get clean, and I did. As for me, I was now put on the death list by a cheering press, starting with the music papers. A new angle. Not interested so much in the music early in 1973. New Musical Express drew up a top 10 of rock stars most likely to die, and put me at number one. I'm also the Prince of Darkness, the world's most elegantly wasted man, and so on. These titles that have stuck to me were coined then and were good forever. I often felt wished to death in this period, even by well-meaning people. At first, you were a novelty. But then, that's what they thought about rock and roll, even into the 60s. And then, they wished you to fuck off. And then when you didn't fuck off, they wished you to death. 10 years I was number one on that list. It used to make me laugh. That was the only chart on which I was number one for 10 years in a row. I was kind of proud of that position. I don't think anybody's held that position as long as I have. I was really disappointed when I went down the charts, finally dropping down to number 9. Oh my God, it's over. These necromantics were given a boost by the story that I went to Switzerland to get my blood changed. Perhaps the one thing everybody seems to know about me. Okay for Keith, he can just go and have his blood changed and carry on. It's said to have been some transaction with the devil. Deep under the stones of Zurich, face white as parchment, a kind of vampire attack in reverse, and the rosiness returns to his cheeks. But I never changed it. That story comes from the fact that when I was going to Switzerland, to the clinic to clean up, I had to land at Heathrow and change planes. And there's the street of shame following me. "Hey, Keith," I said, "look, shut the fuck up. I'm going to have me blood changed." Boom. That's it. And then off to the plane. After that, it's like it's in the Bible or something. I just said it to fob them off. It's been there ever since. I can't untie the threads of how much I played up to the part that was written for me. I mean, the skull ring and the broken tooth and the coal. Is it half and half? I think, in a way, your persona, your image, as it used to be known, it's like a ball and chain. People think I'm still a goddamn junkie. It's 30 years since I gave up the dope. Image is like a long shadow. Even when the sun goes down, you can see it. I think some of it is that there is so much pressure to be that person that you become it, maybe, to a certain point that you can bear. It's impossible not to end up being a parody of what you thought you were. There's something inside me that just wants to excite that thing in other people, because I know it's there in everybody. There's a demon in me, and there's a demon in everybody else. I get a uniquely ridiculous response. The skulls flow in by the truckload, sent by well-wishers. People love that image. They imagined me. They made me. The folks out there created this folk hero. Bless their hearts. And I'll do the best I can to fulfill their needs. They're wishing me to do things that they can't. They've got to do this job. They've got this life. They're an insurance salesman. But at the same time, inside of them is a raging Keith Richards. When you talk of a folk hero, they've written the script for you, and you'd better fulfill it. And I did my best. It's no exaggeration that I was basically living like an outlaw. I got into it. I knew that I was on everybody's list. All I had to do was recant, and I'd be all right. But that was something I just couldn't do. The dope and the cops on our back had gotten to a low point. This is going down the tube. But I never felt that I was. I thought, I can handle this. This is the way things are going. This is the way things are thrown at me. All I have to do is get through. I might have all this shit hitting me from this direction, but I know there's a lot of people out there going, "Go, Keith." In a way, it's an election without a ballot. Who wins? The authorities or the public? And there's me in the middle, or the Stones in the middle. At the time, I suppose sometimes I did wonder, is it just fun for everybody? Keith busted again. Woken up in the fucking early morning with your kids around and you've only been asleep for 2 hours, if that. I don't mind a polite arrest. It was their manners. They barge in like a SWAT team. It really pissed me off. And you can't do anything about it at the particular time. You've just got to swallow it. You know you're being stitched up. Mr. Richards says you shoved him up against the gate and said, "Assume the position," and kicked him in the ankles. Oh, no, 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 wouldn't have done that. Mr. Richards is exaggerating. Non-resident in the UK meant, in those days, that we could spend 3 months or so each year at home. In my case, at Redlands in my house and Cheyne Walk in London. In 1973, that address was under 24-hour surveillance. It wasn't just me. They had their eyes on Mick, too, and busted him a couple of times. Most of that summer, I couldn't go to Redlands. It burned in July when we were there with the children. A mouse ate through the electrical wiring, stripped away the insulation. It was Marlon, age 4, who discovered it, screaming, "Fire! Fire!" It was mostly because of Marlon, Angela was too young to notice it, that I had started to feel a little more serious about the endless cop harassment. He would say, "Dad, why are you looking out the window?" And I'd say, "I'm looking for the unmarked car." And he'd go, "Why, Dad?" And I thought, "Oh, fuck. I can play this game solo, but it's starting to affect my kids. Why are you so frightened of the policemen, Daddy?" "I ain't frightened of them. I'm just keeping an eye out for them." But every day it would be an automatic thing to see whether they were parked across the street. Basically, you were at war. All I had to do was stop taking the stuff. But I thought, first, let's win the war, then we'll decide. Which is probably a really stupid attitude. But that's the way it was. I wasn't going to bow to these motherfuckers. They busted us soon after we got back from Jamaica, in June 1973, when Marshal Chess was staying with us. They found cannabis, heroin, mandrax, and an unauthorized gun. This was perhaps the most famous bust because I faced many, many charges. There were burnt spoons with residue, needles, shooters, marijuana. 25 charges. I also had a brilliant lawyer in the person of Richard Ducan. He was formidable looking, lean, austere. He had famously defended the publisher of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover from prosecution by the government for obscenity. He was, soon after my case, in spite of it perhaps, made chairman of the bar. He told me, "There's nothing we can do about this evidence. You just have to plead guilty, and I'm going to plead mitigation." "Guilty, Your Honour. Guilty." Well, you get a bit hoarse after 15. And the judge is getting bored with this because now he's waiting for Ducan's speech. But the police had added at the last moment a 26th charge, a sawn-off shotgun, which was an automatic year in jail. And I suddenly said, "Not guilty, Your Honour." And the wig went, "What?" The judge was ready for lunch. I was already done for. He said, "Why do you say not guilty to this charge?" And I said, "Because if it was sawn off, Your Honour, why is there a sight on the end of the barrel?" It was an antique miniature, a kid's shotgun that was made for bird hunting by some nobleman in France in the 1880s. Lovely inlay work and everything like that. But it was not sawn off. And the judge looked at the cops, and I could see the cops' faces drain as they realized they'd gone over the top. They'd tried one too many. It was a beautiful moment for me. You can't get gleeful because you know you've just hit them right in the balls. The judge looks at them with a glare that says, "We had him, you idiots." Then Duquesne goes into this amazing Shakespearean speech about artists. And let's face it, the gentleman here is being persecuted. This hardly seems to be necessary, a mere minstrel, etc. And the judge agreed, apparently, because he turned around and said, 10 quid a charge, 250 quid in all. I'll never forget the judge's contempt for the police. He wanted to show them up with this light sentence because it was obvious they were trying to stitch me up. And so to lunch, Duquesne and I. After lunch, I headed for the Londonderry Hotel to celebrate. There, unfortunately, the bedroom caught fire. The corridor filled with smoke, and my little family were ushered out, and indeed banned forever from our favourite hotel. The fire broke out in my room, and Marlon was asleep in my bed, and I leaped through the flames, plucked the boy out, and then waited for the ruckus. It wasn't dangerous and reckless behaviour, as would be assumed by the tabloids. It was faulty wiring in the room. But who would believe that? Ronnie Wood came into the picture in late 1973. We bumped into each other, but we weren't particularly mates. I knew him as a good guitar player with the Faces. I was at Tramps, one of those ongoing clubs at the time, and this blonde came over to me and said, "Hey, I'm Chrissy Wood, Ronnie Wood's old lady." I said, "Oh yeah, nice to meet you. How you doing, girl? How's Ronnie?" And she said, "He's down in Richmond at the house. He's recording there. Do you want to come along?" I said, "I'd like to see Ronnie, so let's go." So I went down with Chrissy to Richmond to their house called The Wick, and I stayed for weeks. At that time, the Stones had some time off. Mick was mixing vocals on It's Only Rock and Roll, and I kind of felt like playing anyway. When I got there, I saw these top men. Willie Weeks on bass, Andy Newmark on drums, and Ian McLagan, Ronnie's buddy from the Faces, on keyboards. I just started to play along. Ronnie was making his first solo album. "I've got my own album to do." A great title, Ronnie. And I walked in on that session, and they gave me a guitar. So that first meeting with Ronnie started over a couple of hot guitars. The next day, Ronnie says, "Let's finish that off." And I say, "Yeah, but I've got to get home back to Cheney Walk." "No, just bring some clothes down." Ronnie had bought The Wick from the actor John Mills, and he had a studio put downstairs in the basement. It was the first time I'd seen a studio deliberately constructed in somebody's house. And I do advise against living on top of a factory. I know. I did it for Exile. But the house was beautiful. The garden sloping down to the river. I had John Mills' almost equally famous actress daughter Haley's bedroom. Not that I used it much, but when I did, I found myself reading a lot of Edgar Allan Poe. Staying down there got me away from the Chelsea surveillance, although they cottoned on eventually. Anita didn't mind. She came down too. There was an extraordinary flow of players and talent concentrated in that time and place, gathered around Woody's record. George Harrison walked in one night. Rod Stewart would pop in occasionally. Mick came and sang on the record. And Mick Taylor played. After not hanging about much on the London rock and roll scene for a couple of years. It was nice to see everybody and not have to move. They'd come to you. It was always jamming. Ronnie and I hit it off straight away. Day in, day out, we had a load of good laughs. He said, I'm running short of songs, so I knocked up a couple of songs for him. Sure, the one you need. And we gotta get our shit together. That's when I first heard It's Only Rock and Roll in Ronnie's studio. It's Mick's song, and he cut it with Bowie as a dub. Mick had gotten this idea, and they started to rock on it. It was damn good. Shit, Mick, what are you doing it with Bowie for? Come on. We've got to steal that motherfucker back. And we did, without too much difficulty. Just the title by itself was so beautifully simple, even if it hadn't been a great song in its own right. I mean, come on. It's only rock and roll, but I like it. Overlapping with Ronnie's record in December 1974, we went to Munich to record Black and Blue, to lay the basic tracks of songs like Fool to Cry and Cheerio Baby. And that was when Mick Taylor dropped his bombshell on us, telling us he was leaving the band and that he had other furrows to plough, which none of us could believe. We were just then planning our US tour of 1975, and he kind of left us in the lurch. Mick could never explain why he left. He doesn't know why. I always asked him, why did you leave? He said, I don't know. He knew how I felt. I always want to keep a band together. You can leave in a coffin or with dispensations for long service, but otherwise you cut. I can't second guess the man. It might have had something to do with Rose, his wife. But the proof that he didn't really fit in is that he left. He didn't want to fit in, I don't think. I guess he felt that with his credentials from being with the Stones, he'd be able to write songs, produce, but he didn't do anything. So early in 75, we were looking for guitar players, and we were in Rotterdam laying down more tracks for Black and Blue. It was the time of Hey Negrita, Crazy Mama, Memory Motel, and of the embryonic Start Me Up, the reggae version that we couldn't make work despite 40 or 50 takes. We would be nagging at it again 2 years later, and then 4 years after that. That slow birth of a song whose perfect non-reggae nature we had discovered in one passing take, without realizing it, even forgetting we'd done it. But that's for laters. We'd been living with Ronnie at the Wick for quite a while, Anita and me and the kids, when I had to go to Rotterdam to record. By this time, we'd discovered policemen in the trees with binoculars in the style of the Carry On comedies, and I wasn't hallucinating. Absurd though it was equally serious. We were being watched now all the time. Surrounded, and I'm on my usual dose. So I told Anita, we're going to have to slide out at night. But first I have to call Marshall Chess, who's already in Rotterdam. Marshall was also hooked. We're in this together. We would score together. I said to Marshall, make sure you've got the shit. I'm not moving until I know that you've got it, because what's the point of Rotterdam in working and cold turkey? As I left, he said, yeah, I've got it. It's right here. I've got it in my hand. Okay. But when I get to Rotterdam, Marshall has this sad, sad look on his face. It's cat litter. They sold cat litter instead of smack. In those days you had brown, usually Mexican or South American smack. Brown or beige crystals which actually looked very much like some cat litter. I was livid. But what's the point of killing the pilot? These fucking Surinamese had sold him cat litter, and we paid top price for it. Instead of being able to zoom along to the studio and start work, we're scrabbling for dope. It makes a man out of you, at least. We spent a nasty couple of days. When you're cold turkey and trying to make a deal at the same time, you're not in a very strong position. The fact that we actually went back to the Surinamese bar is proof of the point. We went down to the depths of the dock area, an almost Dickensian place, like an old illustration, shacks and brick buildings. We looked at the guy behind the bar. Marshall thought it sold it to him, and he goes, that famous pose. Gotcha, sorry, and they're laughing. What you gonna do about it? Forget about it. It's cold turkey, pal. But I didn't say sorry to the stones. Hey, just warm up, get a sound. Give me another 24 hours. Everybody knows what's what. Until I'm in the right condition, I won't appear. Ronnie wasn't necessarily a shoo-in as our new guitarist, despite our closeness at the time. He was still, for one thing, a member of the Faces. We tried other players before him, Wayne Perkins, Harvey Mandel. Both great players, both of them are on Black and Blue. Ronnie turned up as the last one, and it was really a toss-up. We liked Perkins a lot. He was a lovely player, same style, which wouldn't have ricocheted against what Mick Taylor was doing. Very melodic, very well-played stuff. Then Ronnie said he had problems with the Faces. So it came down to Wayne and Ronnie. Ronnie's an all-rounder. He can play loads of things and different styles, and I've just been playing with him for some weeks, so the chips fell there. It wasn't so much the playing when it came down to it. It came down to the fact that Ronnie was English. Well, it is an English band, although you might not think that now. And we all felt we should retain the nationality of the band at the time. Because when you get on the road and it's, have you heard this one? You've all got the same backgrounds. Because of being London-born, Ronnie and I already had a built-in closeness, a kind of code. And we could be cool together under stress like two squaddies. Ronnie was damn good glue for the band. He was a breath of fresh air. We knew he'd got his chops. We knew he could play. But a big decider was his incredible enthusiasm and ability to get along with everybody. Mick Taylor was always a bit morose. You'll not see Mick Taylor lying on the floor, holding his stomach, cracking up with laughter for anything. Whereas Ronnie would have his legs in the air. If you sit Ronnie down, take his mind off everything else, just concentrate all the bits. He's an incredibly sympathetic player. He can surprise you at times. I enjoy playing with him still, very, very much. We were doing You Got the Silver, and I said, well, I can sing it, but I can't sing and play at the same time. You've got to do my bit. And he got it down so much, it was beautiful. He's a lovely slide player, and he genuinely loves his music. It's innocent, totally pure. There are no angles on it. He knows Beiderbecke. He